Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Well, it's another great day in the South. We don't have any rain. I know a lot of people are really wishing they had rain, and when we get it, we really wish we could share it with somebody else, believe me. And today, we're going to be talking about plant-based diet, vegetables. What does that mean? And why should we even be interested in that? I know vegetables, as I would say to many of my local friends here in New Orleans. I know vegetables. It's that stuff I take off of my hamburger when I get it at a fast food place. I don't eat that, quote, salad stuff. Or if frozen vegetables, we always pick them up in, Walmart. We grab a bag, we dump it in. But the kids don't like it very much, so I just kind of stopped buying it. And then the parents who are doing all these green smoothies, And their kids are screaming in the back of the car, and they're still driving through the fast food places. What are we really thinking about our diet these days? That's what we'll be talking about today. And how has it gotten so misconstrued? If we're taking one thing from media, another thing from our past, habits or the way we used to do things, we're kind of mishmashing them. And what are we really looking at in getting nutrition into our body? That is what we should be looking at. I had spoken to a friend the other day, and I said, I am going to pile up all your food one day. I'm going to get a big plastic garbage can, and everything you eat and drink that day, I'm going to dump it in it, and I'm going to leave it there for 5 days. I'm going to ask you to go over there and check it for me. And he's like, no, no way, no how. This person drinks 3 liters of Coke a day, fast food morning, noon, and night, and you just think, how can the body do anything with that stuff? Now, we're not going to be bashing anybody's habits or what they do, but we're just going to be shining the light on options. It says, maybe if you don't really like that salad on top of your hamburger, put it into a blender with some mayonnaise, chop it all up, put it into one of those bullet things and smooth it down. You're not going to know it's in there. Then you just put it back on. Try that trick many times, and it has worked. So my guest on the show today is Jill Nussen now. And Jill, I'm sorry I didn't confirm that with you beforehand. You can correct me when you're on. But she is a veggie queen, and she calls herself a hybrid, a registered dietitian and a culinary educator. But she's been teaching plant-based cooking for more than 25 years. In other words, she's not the media on the fad. She has been doing it. She knows her stuff. She's been eating it and just telling everybody about it for over 25 years. And I think that's really important. Because right now when we're getting on these fad things, it's like, oh, yeah, let's take a little bit of information there and a little bit there and a little bit there, and we can make ours even better. Yeah, I don't think so. So welcome to the show, Jill. And please pronounce your last name, and I am so sorry.
Well, Dr. Gallagher, thank you for having me, and you said my last name correctly. It's Nussenow, so I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
I'm
so sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. It's been mispronounced so many times. It doesn't bother me. My big joke is if my name was not Jill Nussenow, I would like it to be Jill Smith, and I would probably not be called the Veggie Queen. because I have a hard name, so I decided that the Veggie Queen was much easier than my name.
Absolutely, and I think that's a wonderful name. I probably would have said it to myself, maybe decades ago. I myself grew up in the Northeast, just north of Amish country in the 50s and 60s, where we didn't have really grocery stores. It was a newfangled thing because we had the butcher, on the farm. We had the dairy guy down the street, and we had all the farmers. We lived in farm country. So, and to think that we grew up that way, and look how far we've come. And gosh, I go back there and I'm like, this is not even the same thing here anymore. Where has the world gone? And I think that a lot of we're trying to say we want to eat great, but we don't even know how to relate it anymore. Do you think so?
Well, it's interesting you say that because for some reason this morning I started to think about how far we have come from what I would consider real food. And how the Industrial Revolution revolutionized eating in a way that people can't think back to like 100 years. I was trying to think, I wonder if there are statistics, because I don't know that people kept records then, like 100 years ago or 120 years ago, you know, how many people were overweight compared to now? And could you really be overweight because you had to work so hard and food was so fresh and, you know, there wasn't anything frozen because there weren't freezers? And, I mean, all of that is kind of like, I was like, whoa, you know, and it's not that long ago that all of this started. I mean, I teach a culinary class, and we talk about, like, frozen food starting in the 50s.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's not that many years ago to think back and go, wow, it was all fresh.
Yeah.
And that changes everything, really.
You know, I heard a report, I think it was about a month ago, and it said that there is a, of course, you know, media just loves this stuff. Their headline was, microwave sales decline, had a sharp decline. And you read the whole story, and on the bottom line it said, well, countertop microwaves have declined. The in-wall ones have escalated. And it was like, yeah, no kidding. You know what I mean? It was just incredible, you know? And you think, you know, how far we have come in the world. And, I mean, I have a microwave, but I don't use it. You know, the other people in the house do, but that's their choice. And I just, it's just so different. I can remember my mother saying, you know, I need you to go to the store. And the store, you know, might be in the, it was in the late 60s, and it was like you had to walk there, honey. And it didn't matter how far you had to walk or you best have a bike because you weren't getting there otherwise, you know.
And also,
it's just a lifestyle.
Well, the advent of like 7-Eleven and 24-hour groceries, and you know, you can get something to eat any time of day, and our bodies aren't built for that. You know, I don't think we need to eat all day long. I don't think we need to eat the foods that we eat, but it's so readily available. And, you know, one day I had an experience that really kind of brought things into perspective for me. I had been at a meeting, and I was very, very hungry, and I was almost home, and I drove by some fast food place, and I don't eat fast food for many reasons, but they had a sign outside, 99-cent something, and I thought, you know, if I didn't, like, think the way that I think, I would have stopped there in 1 second, and I would have eaten whatever was the 99-cent thing just because I was really hungry. So one of the things that I try to do is to not ever get to that point where I'm so hungry that I would even consider that. And I think that, you know, there's a way to do that, but it's, I know it's just so easy to do the fast food thing because it's there.
I think when we have kids, too, I had four kids. I was a single parent going to school and working, and believe me, that was no treasure. So, you know, we did do the fast food. I mean, you know, we had to. There were times we had to, but most of the time we didn't. And I can remember at one time my kids will always call me this. I was famous for this. I made this soup, and I just usually put whatever's in the refrigerator. And it happened to be purple cabbage that day, and they said, oh, Barney soup. If you can ever remember that Barney character many years ago, it was purple soup, and they thought it was great, so they were good with it. But, you know, and I think bringing fun back into food instead of bringing necessity of, you know, I have to have it now. There is even a hospital here in New Orleans, and they had a bulletin board up, and they had an elderly, heavy-set woman on it, and the slogan was, do what you wanna, actually just pronounced just like that and written like that. And then on the bottom it says, because we're here for you. And I thought, sad, super sad. And how far have we come?
Well, I think part of it is, and I think the kids are a great way because, you know, we have school, I'm in Northern California, we have school gardens, and I remember my son, when he went to school, I helped sometimes with the school gardens, but usually I helped in the classroom teaching cooking with the kids, which they loved. And one time his teacher said to me, we grew all this chard, how can I cook it? And I have actually the story in my book, The Veggie Queen, and it's called Chard of a Different Color, or something like that. Anyway, I told the teacher how to prepare the chard, and he prepared it, and he said the kids ate it. And my son came home and said, could you make me chard? And I was pretty blown away. I went out and I got it, and I live where Luther Burbank was, and he developed this rainbow chard. So it comes in all these different colors. So I got all the different colors of chard, and I cooked it for him. And he said, oh, no, I only like the red ones.
Oh, good.
Which I thought was so funny. But he said, oh, and then he said to me, and his teacher's name was Nathan, Nathan made it better. And I thought, that is so funny. I gave Nathan the recipe. But it was an opportunity for these kids to, like, try something different. And just to say, the reason I'd never cooked him chard is because chard does not agree with my body. So I don't eat it, but I eat a lot of other greens. So I'd never cook chard for him. And he never would have tried it if he didn't have it at the school garden. And, you know, it's just a way to really – and so a lot of the kids would go home and ask the parents for the food, which is wonderful. And we had a similar experience when he was in kindergarten. I got started pressure cooking, which is what one of my books, The New Fast Food, is all about. And my most requested and loved recipe is Shane's Fabulous Lentil Soup. So Shane was in kindergarten. He did a report on lentils. And it was fascinating. You know, he loved doing this little research report and glued him to the paper and brought him in, and I made the soup. And I thought, okay, well, I'm making this giant pot of soup. I'm coming home with soup. And I went in there, and only one of the kids had ever tried lentils before. And he would not try them. But all the other kids ate them, loved them, and then all the moms asked me for the recipe. And I was like, wow, it's pretty easy, you know, when they're just learning about food. And oftentimes at that point, they're willing to try a lot of things. And I think it's really the kind of sometimes the door in, because as we get older, we get more set in our ways and think, oh, I don't like that food and I'm not going to eat it. But, you know, when you have kids, you're always telling them, well, just try a bite, you know, just see what it tastes like. And, you know, the first time they try it, they don't always like it. And, you know, we have that experience, too. It's like, oh, I don't think I really like, you know, cabbage. Or, you know, my husband will say things like that. I don't like cabbage. And then we have this cabbage salad that we get at this restaurant. And he's like, I love that stuff. I'm like, it's cabbage.
You know, I think it's really interesting, too, because with children, we as adults tend to put our thoughts and beliefs and habits on the children. In other words, if we're not a vegetable person, you're not going to find them in their house, you know. And that's kind of like a shortcoming all the way around, because then those kids never really get exposed to it. I know a friend of mine has never, ever had vegetables in the house at all. And they're pretty much meat and potatoes, and it is an absolute chore. If there's a little fragment of lettuce on the dish, he'll send the dish back, you know?
Excuse me.
But that's where, you know, our beliefs and our habits really come into play. So really by, you know, parents growing up, I think the parents need to have some exposure to this when they're younger to be able to bring it forth in their adult life. I know my own children, you know, they ate extremely well when they were younger. They went way off of it when they were in their teens, but now they're way back on it again in their 20s when they should be parents, 20s and 30s. So it's perfect.
That's good news.
You know?
My son did the same thing, and my nephew actually did the same thing, and my sister said, don't worry, he'll come back to it because it's what he knew. But there must be something about that rebellious teen years that kind of sends them off the charts. But I think, you know, I mean, before I started doing what I was doing, or what I have been doing, teaching cooking, I worked in perinatal new mothers, kids, and pregnant women. And pregnant women was the perfect time to start teaching about nutrition, because it was like, now you can think about it. And then once you have a child, you're like, oh, well, maybe I should feed them the good food because that would be good for them. And so it is a time. And, you know, like I said, they don't always like the thing at first. So it's a multiple time thing. But if you don't eat it, this is what I say, if you don't eat it, they're never going to eat it. And
right.
my husband, you know, I actually, my son loved and still loves sweet potatoes and winter squash, and my husband didn't grow up with that. And he'd say to me, "You eat that?" And my son would be like, "Yes." So, you know, it is a question of, like, sometimes stepping out of your comfort zone to get them something. My son was born in the spring, and so when he started eating solid foods, it was kind of the late fall, winter. And I was like, okay, I want to get him some fresh vegetables. And I just was like, what am I going to get him? I went to the farmer's market, and this farmer said to me, "Well, why don't you try some turnips?" They were these beautiful little white turnips. And I was like, okay. And I brought them home, and I cooked them. And then, of course, I tasted them because I didn't want to give him something I hadn't tasted. And he loved them, and I did too. And I'd really never had turnips before. And I thought, this is wonderful. And so I just kept trying more things for him and eating more things for me. And, you know, it's all a learning process. And I think that's what people need to keep in mind. It's not like you have to fall in love with, you know, collard greens, which a lot of people do once they eat them. But, you know, if you haven't grown up with them, maybe you don't like them as much as you could. And additionally, I think the important thing, because this did happen to me, I lived in Florida and I bought collard greens and I didn't know anything. Yeah. I was a college student. I didn't know anything about them, and I didn't realize that the heat makes them supremely bitter. And then when I tried them again and they were in different conditions, I was like, oh, those are really good. So I think it's not only knowing that what the food is, but the time of year and when it's best and, you know, how you can make it taste the best through cooking. I mean, there's a lot of things to it. It's not just the food. I mean, here right now, you know, you can't get decent tomatoes. It's only April. But in August, we're going to have tons of beautiful tomatoes. So, you know, one of my rules is the food never tastes better than what you started with. I mean, you can jazz it up, but, you know, you got to start with good ingredients.
It has been so funny because at one time I was going to take a little test for myself, and one of the big stores I had gone, and it was in January, and I said, wow, look at that. You know, I really would like a tomato. I don't know why. They're just always have been I've loved them forever in a million years because I grew up on them. We used to go to the farmer's market, and we would always wait till the end of the farmer's market because the farmers were never allowed to pick anything ahead of time. They had to be picked within 24 hours to be able to show up at the farmer's market, and then they would all make sure they sold it because they knew they couldn't sell it anywhere else then. And So, yeah, that was a rule there because it was in the edge of Amish country, and that's what they believed. And tomatoes, I would get a bushel, and I would be eating them in the back of the car and then wondering why I had a rash 2 days later. But it didn't matter because I could eat 10 and 20 at a pop. You know, that would just be me. Or we would buy green peppers. I'd do the same thing. Or I'm Irish, same thing with potatoes. Those were the things I grew up with. But this thing with kale lately and people, and it's like, I just can't get into it. I'm sorry. There's just no way, no how. It's not going to happen. Collard greens, I don't care what you do, and you could stick them in all the baking fat you want to, but I'm not going anywhere near them. But if you put tomatoes and green peppers, that's my trinity that I put in everything. It's got to have tomatoes, green peppers, it's got to have an entire head of garlic, and it's got to have two onions, and that's my thing. Well, anyway,
not
I started
with the collards.
No.
Did you try it with the collards?
No, thank you. but what I did was I went in January to the big store, and it had I said, okay, in January, I know citrus is going to be great, you know, because it's Florida. We live one state over from Florida. We should have great citrus now. Well, all of the citrus was from South Africa. Now, I'm sorry, but to get it there in January from South Africa, you had to have picked it green. You had to have picked it 2 or 3 months prior to get it into the stores. And then I did another test, and I went to one big store, and I really wanted a Vidalia onion because, again, those are from Florida. Well, it had a sticker on it, and it said conventional, and it was not from Florida. And I went to the other store that's a big one, the healthy one. And when I got there, I looked. It was the same sticker as the other store.
Wow.
So in other words, don't always think where you're, you know, when you go through those golden arches, you think that the store has 100% everything that's healthy. Ding dong, not true. It was the same merchandise that had been sold at the other store. And
wow,
it was like a really mind blower. And then I had another sticker. I had taken, you know, the little stickers off. I bought one of each to, you know, to hold on to the sticker. And it was the end of June, beginning of July, and I said, oh, great, tomatoes, my gosh, come on, you know. Dead heat of the summer, the dead of the south, we should have tomatoes coming out our ears, right? The store, it had tomatoes from Canada. It was
wow.
Like, I didn't even think that Canada still had sun yet in June, you know. They got to still
maybe
be putting
they were
seedlings
greenhouse
in the ground.
Hothouse tomatoes.
Yeah. No, they were these weird, funky tomatoes, and they had a Canada sticker on. People were buying them, and I'm going, oh, my Lord. So that, I try to teach people all the time about food. You've got to know where it comes from. You've got to eat
absolutely
in season. And if it isn't there, don't buy it.
Well,
go
I
without
think
that's it.
A hard
go
concept,
to something
you
else.
Know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you go to the store, you see, I mean, I just saw at the store yesterday, I think nectarines or something. I'm like, where are the nectarines coming from in
yes
April?
Yeah.
And I didn't even actually look. I mean, I looked at them, but I didn't pick them up. And I think it is a concept to try and learn when the produce is the best. But I have like a little thing that I tell people because it helps a little bit. So spring is basically the shoots. And summer, which is longer and shorter in different places, is the fruits. Fall and winter are the roots, and there is some overlap. So, like, in spring, you get peas and asparagus, and what else is in spring? Just, like, the greens coming up.
Right, the short lettuces, yeah.
Right. And then in the summer, you have the fruits. So you have, like, the peppers, the eggplant, the tomatoes, the squash, I mean, it's all the fruit of the plant plus fruit. And then the fall is things that you can harvest, like the winter squash and the celery root and the beets and onions and all of those things that are roots and parsnips and potatoes. And so it's just kind of a way to look at it. So, like, berries fall under the fruits. So when you see blackberries in January, they're not that
yeah
good. And I actually have a story in my book about eggplant. And I have a friend who's from Wisconsin. And so it is a really hard concept because she's from Wisconsin. She's into food. She's lived in California for a number of years. And she said, oh, I went to the store. And she went to this local, it's called Community Market, and she bought an eggplant in January. And she said to me, this is a true story, she said, that it wasn't very good. And I said, well, you bought an eggplant in January. How good could it be?
Yeah.
And she didn't get it. And then, like, when I explained it to her, she understood that eggplant really is a summer fruit. And it is something that is really best when you have it. Just like anything, like this time of year is potentially one of the worst times of years for fruit for us here in California, because it's the storage apples, the ends of the pears, the citrus is winding down. The good thing is the strawberries are coming, and they're starting, and they're good. But other than that, we're kind of still stuck in apple, pear, citrus season, which is what I call winter, and the fall. And it's really, there's not a lot of fresh fruit around. So it's a time when I use, if I'm going to have fruit, more citrus, more frozen fruit, just because that's what there is. And when you taste the fruit that's not, and fruit is a better example because many more people like fruit than vegetables. But when you taste a fruit in season, like let's say a peach, you know, there's nothing like biting into a peach over a sink
right
or outside and having the juice run down your arm and drip down your elbow
right
and land on the ground. But that doesn't happen with winter fruit with peaches from Chile in January because they have to be shipped. you know.
But I think many people may have not experienced that in the first place. Therefore, they're not able to base that decision upon what is good or what is not. And I think that's where you and I come in to say what is good and what isn't. Because I can remember Pennsylvania was fabulous for apples and tomatoes and peaches. And the funniest thing was, I mean, in Pennsylvania, they're dense, they're juicy, they're about a handful, they're not over huge. And, I mean, they were just like, that's why I said the farmer's market, was they picked them then, they're going to rot in 2 days because they are so fresh and not sprayed. Well, I had moved to Arizona, and I heard there were peaches, and I'm going, I do not get that, but I will go see. My daughter and I went to pick them, and they were bigger than baseballs, softballs even. They were astronomically huge. And what had happened to the peaches in the desert is that they sucked all the water or moisture they possibly could to keep it inside of the tough peach skin so that the peach could grow. And it was incredible because when you sliced it down, all it was water. It wasn't even that peachy juice that you used to get out of the Northeast or out of Georgia. It was more like liquidy, like just light yellow. It was crazy. And I'm going, these are just don't even taste like the peaches. So I think people don't always have the concept of what really, really good food is, what it tastes like.
I think you're right. And one of the things that's so interesting, though, is the growth of the farmers market. They've grown like 75% in the last 20 years. So at some time of year, almost most people live somewhat near a farmer's market where they can get out at least once and see what's there. And my students at the Santa Rosa Junior College where I teach, one of their things they have to do for a project is they must go to the farmer's market. And I tell them when you go to the farmer's market, the nice thing is you don't have to think, is this in season? Because as you say, they just picked it. And so you know it's in season. And you can just look around, you know, if you go today and you go in May, you go in June, you can see how the seasons change. And related to this is if you could grow a plant wherever you live, grow a plant of something because it will change how you look at your food. And if you have kids, kids love growing plants. I mean, I grew a tomato called the Green Zebra, and I had an opportunity to take a trip to France. And when I was there, my husband called me. My son was 2 and a half, and he kept saying, every time I take him outside, he keeps talking about zebras. What is going on? And I said, he's telling you about the tomato plant. And he said to me, what? I said, yeah, it's called the Green Zebra. And he's like, oh. So I think that, you know, even if you grow a pot of herbs, I mean, growing anything changes what you do. But and also you can taste. Like, you don't have to buy a whole thing of thyme. You can see what fresh thyme tastes like. You can see what basil tastes like. And so I think there's a lot to it. And, yes, you have to start somewhere. And I think people's taste buds have gotten out of whack because we're so used to sugar, salt, and fat from our food that we don't really know what a fresh green bean is supposed to taste like or a sugar snap pea or, you know, and people are like, ooh, and it's like, wait, just, you know, give yourself a couple weeks without that other food and taste this and you might change your mind.
Well, let's talk about the plant-based diet, and what I just believe the plant-based diet to me is just plain eating more vegetables in your diet, more vegetables and fruits, period. In other words, when you used to have the plate, I'm sure you remember this a long time ago, the meat and the potatoes or the starch used to take up 75% of the dish, and they would have like a little 10% of a vegetable, and you would have another 10% of a bread. Do you remember that dish a long time ago? It was a long, long time ago. But you know, and it always used to be that that's how. But we have to remember that that's important because that's how our elders grew up. That's how, you know, 60s on up. So those are our grandparents that we're sending our kids to. That's how they ate. And then if that's how they ate, that's also how they fed their children who are now in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So what we're really looking at is generations of change. So now we're saying put more vegetables into it. So really you want to be looking at the kids and, you know, up to about 30s and 40s so they can start understanding this is generations that will change it, but we should do it across all generations.
Absolutely. And included with that, I would include, even though the fruits and vegetables, of course, are top of my priority list, I'd also include beans because beans have been eaten for centuries, like beans, peas, and lentils for centuries, very well by many people, and they're inexpensive and they're really tasty. And even the USDA, which is not my governing body, says that you should include legumes at least 3 times a week as part of what you eat. And it's just a way to kind of move the meat, move away from meat a little bit more. And many people eat beans but don't really look at it that way by eating chili, by eating baked beans and soups and things like that. So I think that people do eat beans, but they don't think of them always as something to include, or just putting them on a salad or eating a three-bean salad or... So I would include those two, definitely. But, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and he does Japanese food, and he does it very well, and he's Japanese. And he said, well, I was thinking about putting together these meals for diabetics. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And he said, well, you know, I wasn't really sure what to put. And I said, well, this is what I would recommend. I said, why don't you put, like, 1/4 brown rice, and 1/4 the protein, chicken or fish or whatever you're doing, and the other half all vegetables. And he was like, oh. And so he kind of got it. He didn't really have a concept for what it would be. And I said, you know, if you cut down on that starch part and make the protein like a decent part, but really, I said, the thing is, when people see a plate and it's large, it looks large and it has lots and lots of vegetables on it, it looks different in their mind than if they just get a little bit. Oh, excuse me 1 minute. I will be right back. I'm so sorry.
Sure.
Sure.
And what we'll be talking about, too, is we're going to be also talking... Go ahead. We'll be talking about Jill's book, and her books are The New Fast Food, The Veggie Queen Pressure Cooks Whole Food Meals in Less Than 30 Minutes. I don't know about you, but there's times when I just plain have to resort to a can, but the rest of the meal, 90%, is fine. So you really need to not beat yourself up about that. But pressure cooking looks like a way to go. And also her other book is The Veggie Queen, Vegetables Get the Royal Treatment. You know, and I think that's important, too, because in the Veggie Queen book, it does have a lot of salads, and it has a lot of different ideas on mixing things together, like braised baby artichokes with shallots and garlic. And it's like, that sounds so simple, but do you actually do it, or do you just wait and have that done at a restaurant? And what about pea and asparagus risotto? I mean, that sounds like something that sounds so hard. There's just no way I can comprehend that. But in Jill's books, these are very simple recipes. I mean, the directions are just very short. And it's not like you're looking at directions that are so extended that you have to get all of these things that you might not even have in your kitchen. And then what will happen over a period of time when you start learning to cook with plants and fruits and vegetables is that you will have some of these different spices in your home. You will have some of these different things that you might not have always had before, but as you collect one or two, your collection will start to grow too. And it's really important. In her book, the Veggie Queen book, Vegetables Get the Royal Treatment, she does talk about vegetables as seasonal. And that is what we've already said on the show, is about eating in season. And it is so important to eat in season because that is when the vitamins and enzymes are in those products, in those plants, at the highest levels. If you're picking something too early, it's not going to have a chance to get all those enzymes and vitamins in it. If you wait and it's over ripened, you're cutting off half of it and it's already over expired itself. You have to think of fruits and vegetables also in the more like life, you know. When a child is, you know, you really want to keep them as long as they can because they will be the best and they will be the healthiest and it will be really the best for the child. Well, think about plants too. You know, you really want to keep them on the vine as long as you can. And when they're ready to go, they're ready to go. You don't want to be taking them off early, putting them in trucks, and waiting, you know, for 6 months, gas those suckers and bring them to the local store, which is what is occurring today. Jill does live on the West Coast, and I have relatives over there, and many times my relatives would tell me about, see that truck over there? That's full of tomatoes. They picked those. Oh, hey, they took them right off the vine, and they're going to gas them, and you'll see them in your store. You know, in the middle of December when you're cutting that tomato for your Christmas dinner, that's where it is. It's just sitting in there waiting. Well, that's not really the best food. And she, in her book, The Pressure Cooks, are you back, Jill?
I am back.
Oh,
I've been
okay.
Back listening to you.
Oh, sorry.
You're doing great.
And in the one that that talks about the pressure cooks is all about pressure cooking. And what I have believed in is coming about is that everybody is drinking these smoothies. It's a cold. In Chinese medicine, that's coldness. It's raw fruits. It's raw vegetables. It's too much sugar. And it's something you're drinking. You aren't chewing. You aren't using the enzymes in your body to be able to break the food down. You've already put it in some kind of weird factor kind of thing to, like, mix it up. And that's really not the best for your body, because if you keep doing these over and over again, you're going to deplete the warmness of your body, the nurturing part of your body. And that's so vitally important, because if you think of yin and yang, you've got to have a balance. And when I saw about the pressure cooker, I thought that would be a great idea for that balance. Because you really do need both. You can't just have one. You know, you're doing all this detoxing, but what are you doing to actually feed the organs of your body? And that's the most important part. So, Jill, do you have anything to say on that about the pressure cooker? I really think warm foods is so vitally important.
Well, it's interesting. I'm working on my third book, which should be out very soon. And I have an eating rule, and one of my eating rules is when you eat something cooked, eat something raw. And it's very simple, and it sometimes it's just like the chopped herbs on top of your food. But there's a lot of things about the pressure cooker that make the food so good, and people don't really understand it. But something has happened in the last few years is there's these electric pressure cookers, and people love them because
yeah.
They're really easy. You throw the food in, and you push a button, and you come back, or you let the pressure out. It's very simple to do. The food tastes great because it's being cooked without air at a fairly high heat, but for a very short time. So I can make broccoli in my pressure cooker in 1 or 2 minutes at pressure. I cannot replicate what I do in there by steaming my food. So it's like what I call it is it's like a slow cooker on steroids, and it's like super steaming your food, but you keep the nutrients in the food. And so it's a great way to cook. Many people find that they really prefer the food. I had a woman whose husband didn't like broccoli because it has all of those sulfur compounds, and he just found it too stinky. But he loves the broccoli that comes out of the pressure cooker, because those volatile compounds just somehow magically kind of disappear. So I think it's a great way. I mean, I think people are over-kaling themselves with these smoothies and just not really thinking, although I do make a smoothie for my husband every morning because he was one of those people who ate nothing in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's taken a number of years. I want to say it's 5 or 6, and he now drinks a smoothie, and now he also eats oatmeal, which is perfect because then he's getting even more. And he said to me just yesterday, he said, wow, I ate that oatmeal, and, you know, I felt great all day. And I thought, wow, you know, I mean, and this is a man who doesn't really talk about food very much. So it's kind of interesting. I do not drink smoothies for quite a number of reasons, I love to chew my food. And because digestion begins in your mouth, something doesn't work for me when I just drink a smoothie. I don't feel satisfied. It just doesn't work for me, so I don't do it. And also, it's usually quite a number of calories that are in these drinks that you make. And if you're not putting other things in there to balance it out, oftentimes a lot of sugar from the fruit that you're putting in or the juice you're putting in. I discovered this a number of years ago. I wrote an article about smoothies, and it came about because I was taking my son to the airport to take a trip, and we were there, and he said, oh, will you buy me a smoothie? And the drink mm-hmm. was literally like 28 ounces, and it was just yeah. fruit and juice blended together, and I thought, that's a lot of fruit there. I mean, he'd never sit down and eat that kind of fruit. So to just drink it seemed really excessive. And then I thought, there are a lot of people who are doing this. This is not such a good idea. And so I think there are issues. And also the studies seem to show that when people just drink their calories, they get like 30% more calories than if they actually eat the food. And I always try to remind people with, like, orange juice or apple juice. I said, you know, if you've ever squeezed orange juice, you know in order to get, like, 8 ounces of juice, you have to squeeze 3 or 4 oranges. And if you wouldn't right. sit down and eat 3 or 4 oranges, then you're just getting too much of the natural sugar that's in there. So there's
yeah,
a lot
they have
to
no
it.
Concept of that.
Right, right. So you have, if you can think about that and you literally sat down and squeezed oranges, you'd go, oh, you know, I mean, most people will sit down and eat an orange. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we're just not paying attention to. But pressure cooking, I'm sold on pressure cooking. I've been teaching it for almost 20 years. I've taught thousands of people how to do it. I hope to continue to teach thousands and thousands more to get over their irrational fear of pressure cooking. Even if they've seen some bad things with pressure cookers, the new pressure cookers are very safe and easy to use, and they can turn people's lives around because what used to take hours now takes minutes. And, you know, I call it the new fast food because I really think it can replace fast food, especially in terms of, like, eating more vegetables. And I don't use it for chicken and various other meats, but you can use a pressure cooker for those things. And it is fast and easy and very tasty.
Now, when you're teaching about using the pressure cooker, it's not like I'm just going to do my broccoli now and then I'm going to take it out. Then I'm going to do my rice and I'm going to take it out. Then I'm going to put this in and take it out. Is it making full meals in there or is it just making pieces of meals?
Well, I do some combination dishes in there. You know, I actually have a recipe that I was one of my first published pressure cooking recipes, which was for chicken fajitas and rice, because I was writing it for I wrote it for Cooking Light, actually, I believe, or my local newspaper, I can't remember. And it's a one-dish meal. Everything goes in because white rice in the pressure cooker only takes 3 minutes at pressure. And so the rice was being cooked along with the vegetables that were in it, along with the chicken that was in it. So it was really easy to do. The way that I eat, I do a lot of, like, individual things because I think it works out better that way for me. So I might cook, like, a big pot of beans. Or, you know, I love to make stew in there, you know, vegetable stew or bean stew or chili or so you can do all kinds of mixed things. You could do separate things. You can cook a whole chicken in there if you wanted to. But I do a lot of things. I've been working on my fourth cookbook, which is another pressure cooking cookbook, and I've been making veggie burgers every day, multiple times a day. And I sometimes cook the things together for it. So, like, I did one with lentils and quinoa. I did one with mung beans and millet. More unusual things that most people aren't going to have had. But you can do the individual ingredients or you can do them all together. And it's whatever you really like. Like, you can do black beans and brown rice together in the pressure cooker and season it. That's the whole thing. It's when you cook in the pressure cooker, you increase the seasoning because you need to because of the pressure. And it turns out so tasty. So if you ever make soup, you know, the next day it tastes better, soup or sauce, it tastes better the next day. When you open the pressure cooker, it tastes the way that it would taste the second day right then.
And that's really important because sometimes you'll cook broccoli on the stove or you'll cook, like, something else on the top of the stove. And when you take it off and you drain it, if you're boiling it or steaming it, then you go ahead and you season it. But really that seasoning is just laying on the top of it. It's doing really not very much. It's just kind of there, you know, as maybe to say that you did it, I guess. But in the pressure cooker, it tends to infuse into the food, right?
Absolutely. I have a recipe. I'm just going over my recipe list of what I'm going to include in my next book that I have in the old book, but ones that I can't really part with, like Shane's Fabulous Lentil Soup. But the other one is Big Time Broccoli. It could not be a simpler recipe. It's basically broccoli, vegetable broth, and thyme. And when you take it out, it tastes spectacular. I mean, and it takes literally 1 to 2 minutes at pressure, and that thyme is infused into the broccoli. And it's just, it always amazes me when I make this. So it's kind of fascinating to see what happens in the pressure cooker. And it gives people an opportunity. One of the things that a lot of people don't really do, especially if they're just learning to cook, is to add seasoning to their food because it's very important. And additionally, the herbs and spices are incredible sources of antioxidants and great nutrition. So even though we use them for flavor, they're actually adding a lot to people's diet when they add herbs and spices. So my next book, which is called Nutrition Champs, the second chapter is herbs and spices. And so it's a way to kind of like get people to go beyond, you know, their garlic salt. You know, because I think people are afraid of herbs and spices because they're like, oh, I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know how to use that. And, you know, I think we've expanded, but I think we're not quite there yet. But I think we can get there.
And, you know, I can remember when I was in Scottsdale, my most favorite lunch was on this very dark rustic bread, and they had chicken salad with lavender. And it was actual lavender plant. There was actual lavender plant in there. There were the flowers, you know, and the leaves. And it was all inside the chicken. And it was the best that you ever had. I mean, that place just always smelled good. So it drew people in. And it was actually all of the flowers and herbs that they were using in the food. So it was really great.
Right.
And that's something that's
think,
so
you know,
unique.
Yeah, well, we don't always explore what's in front of us. I mean, there's a lot of wild foods people can eat, too. And I think the whole thing is that many of these plants provide incredible nutrition for us, and they're what we are meant to eat. So I think whether it's a fruit or a vegetable and it's in season, we're really meant to eat these foods. We need them to nourish our blood, our bodies, or, you know, all of us. I told a friend, I said, I can't imagine not eating something green every day. It's part of what makes our blood work. And she said, well, I said, it's like chlorophyll for a plant. You know, they need that. We need the greens to make us work. And I love what you said about, you know, when to harvest the fruit or the vegetable. You know, we do need it at peak of harvest, and we're not used to that only because of the industrial food system, but we have lots and lots of regional food supplies where we can get food that's more local if we seek it out. And I know it's not easy. It's not always the easiest thing. But if you start at the basics in life, I think nourishing your body is one of the very best things you can do to feel better about everything you do.
And I think for people to not be afraid to start adding plants in, no matter what type plant it is. And I know that my family that I'm with right now is not really into that. And I had some leftovers in the refrigerator, and I was making just some vegetable broth. And I said, what can I do to this? So I put in some tomatoes, and I said, okay, they're not going to eat tomatoes. So I did put it in one of those chopper things so they could not know that it was chunks of tomato, that we disguised that. Then I looked in the refrigerator, and there was leftover brown rice. So in that went. There was also some leftover stir fry. I chopped up that stir fry that I had made the day before, put it in another one of those machines to just loosely chop it, threw that in. And yes, I had to resort, because I don't have a pressure cooker, to a can of beans, black beans, but those went in it too. When they came home, they said, oh my gosh, this is so great. This tastes like the tortilla soup from that place down the road. I said, yeah, it's all your leftovers that just went in the chopper. So people can just be inventive. They're just afraid. They think that they have to have this big exorbitant, you know, process, when really all I did was just take what we already had. I just disguised it a little, and you ate it, and you didn't even think to blink, you know?
Well, I think that's the whole thing. I mean, I think simple food is often the best. And also, if you can be creative with your food, just like you were. People are afraid. I think we've gotten to the generations where people are afraid to do anything with their food. And I teach students from age like 15 to 80 in my junior college cooking classes. And what I noticed about 10 years ago, I said to my department chair, we need the how to boil water class, because my students really don't know how to do anything. And I always tell people, if you can boil water, you can make a pot of beans, you can make a pot of rice, you can cook some vegetables, you can make pasta, you can do a lot of things, but people don't necessarily have the experience. And I try to tell people, because this is really true, if you don't have people like, well, I did it wrong. And I see this because I have classes of 25 people. I did it wrong. I'm like, we're here to learn. And you don't always want to learn when you're making your dinner, but people expect that they ought to be able to know how to cook. But just like if you're driving a car, you didn't learn in one day. You have to keep practicing, and you have to keep doing it, and then you learn how to cook better. And if you're not learning how to cook better, then there are more cooking teachers and more online stuff these days than ever before. If you cannot get on, I have YouTube videos, which is under YouTube at The VQ. People can watch and see, how do I use a pressure cooker? How do I make a pot of quinoa? How do I make, you know, whatever? How do I make stock? I mean, people, I'm always blown away. I do cooking demonstrations at farmers markets and various other places, and people will be like, now, how did you make that stock? And I usually make it right there on the spot, and it's, you know, the last one I made, which was last week, was the ends of asparagus, the shells of peas, some spring onion, some garlic, some bay leaf, some thyme, and water. And that was it. And they were like, wow, that's really nice. I'm like, oh, I just put the stuff in there. I didn't really do anything except get it cooking. And so, you know, there's like, wow, that's magical. And it's like, no, it's really easy. You just have to do it, and you have to repeat it, and you just have to keep thinking, wow, did this taste better than the last time? And just pay, you know, it's about your senses. It's not just about throwing things in a pot, but like, did it smell good? Did it look good? Did it taste good? You know, what did it sound like? You know, what did it feel like? And there's just a lot to it, but it's really paying attention. And I think one of the unfortunate things is, many times we don't give ourselves enough time to pay attention these days, because everything's so fast. And sometimes it's just slowing down and saying, you know, I'm going to wait. And if you're not going to do it in a pressure cooker, I'm going to wait 45 minutes and I'll cook a pot of brown rice. Because you can make brown rice for a week in one pot of brown rice. You don't have to cook every day. You can cook more. You can freeze it. You can do whatever you want with it. But I think feeding yourself is a basic skill and a basic need, and something that needs to happen in order to be the most productive person you can. I think people are over-caffeinated and undernourished.
And that is true. You know, I can remember when I was even made that. They said, well, make that again. And I said, I could never replicate it. All I know is that I put in what I had, and that's what the joy of cooking is all about. It's about doing what you have, use what you have, and do the best with it. And that's important because, you know, it's great to always have recipes and say, well, I don't have anything of this. But if you have missing one or two items, you can sometimes substitute for something that you do have already in your pantry.
Well, I have a friend who assists me at my cooking classes, and one of my rules is don't use what you don't have. And people always laugh, and I'm like, no, it's true. Don't use what you don't have. And she used to think, and she knows how to cook, she used to think if she didn't have the 2 cloves of garlic in a recipe, she couldn't make the recipe. And now she knows you don't use what you don't have. You've tried to find a substitute, and if you can't, just make it anyway, unless garlic was the main ingredient, and then you need it. But many people, I think they need to start with recipes. They need to start with something. But a recipe is not written in stone. It's a way for you to get an idea and just go, oh, yeah. And instead of using broccoli, I could use green beans, you know, if you didn't have the thing that it is. So I think it's just really, it's becoming familiar. And when people become more familiar with cooking and making food for themselves, it becomes easier. Even just, you know, making a salad becomes easier the more you do it. And knowing a good lettuce from not a good lettuce, you know, which kind do you like? Do you like romaine or do you like red leaf lettuce? Or do you like them mixed together? You know, it's like it does take a little bit of thought, but not that much. Or maybe you don't even want to deal with the lettuce and you just want to get a bag, which would be my last choice. But if it's what's, and I always say, do what's going to make the food get into your mouth.
Right.
You know, there's no perfection. It's really about eating the best that you can eat. And how can you eat more plants? Does it mean you grow parsley and put it on top of your dish? Do you love cilantro and you'd love to make cilantro pesto and use that instead of basil? You know, there's so many ways that you can jump off in cooking and preparing food and just learning what you need to feel healthy and feel well. And I say, you know, the subtitle of my next book is The Veggie Queen's Guide to Eating and Cooking for Health, Happiness, and something like that. So it's really just to keep you healthy and happy.
Well, Jill, we really blew through this hour. I didn't think we would have so much to say about plants that people would be so interested, but we've really gone around the whole gamut of talking about it in a light way so people could understand it. And I think it's so funny you said about with having a plant and cooking and using it like basil. I had a huge basil plant on my patio, and one day I wanted to make something, and I said, just chop the plant right down to the bottom and give it to me, and the whole plant went in. It's like I can't grow plants fast enough to be able to use them. So, but hey, what are you going to do?
You need more plants then.
I'm telling you. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Could you please give us information where to find your books and your website, and are you having any events coming up?
Okay. My books are available on my website, which is www.theveggiequeen.com. And you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, and everything's under The Veggie Queen. My book's also available on Amazon, but I prefer to sell it from my website. The upcoming events, I'm going to be in Washington State at the Mother Earth News Fair on, I think it's May 31st. It could be June 1st, I cannot recall, but that weekend, that's where I'll be. And I'm always online, and people can send me emails to jill@theveggiequeen.com, and I love to interact and get people excited and inspired about eating more vegetables.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Gallagher.
Thank you. If you'd like more information about Jill, the Veggie Queen, please do check out her website. The link is on today's show page, and the link to purchase her books is also there. And the books are The New Fast Food, The Veggie Queen Pressure Cooks Whole Food Meals. And let me tell you, it's a lot easier to be able to do it that way. You can make a meal in less than 30 minutes. You know, that time that you have to get the kids in the car, go out to get something fast food, and come back and, like, still hungry. Her other book is The Veggie Queen, Vegetables Get the Royal Treatment. So when we talk about plant-based diets, what we're really talking about is adding more fruits and vegetables, which are plants, to your diet. Instead of having them just on a little side dish to the side of your main plate, maybe they should be at least one-half or two-thirds of your plate. Give it a try. If you'd like more information, please do contact Jill. If you'd like more information, please feel free to contact me. It is at outoftheboxhealthcare.com. And this is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It has been a pleasure, and thank you so much for being with us today.